Heidi, your silence is commanded.
Good morning. Please have a seat. Good morning, everybody. We are here today on Legend Lake Property Owners Association versus Guy. Is it Kashena or Kashina? Kashina. May I please have the appearances? Good morning. Good morning. And what I have this morning is 25 minutes for Attorney Roy, 7 minutes for Attorney Dash, and then 5 minutes.
25.
What did I see? 3. Thank you. 20, let me start. Let me put my glasses on. I have 25 minutes for Attorney Olson. I have 23 minutes for Attorney Roy. I have 7 minutes for Attorney Dash, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal. Okay, everyone had it right except Jill. Whenever you're ready. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
May it please the court, we are here today with a simple request for fairness and to hold the United States Congress to its sacred word. In the Menominee Restoration Act, Congress stated, except as specifically provided in this act, nothing contained in this act shall alter any property rights or obligations, any contractual rights or obligations, including existing fishing rights or any obligations for taxes already levied. Throughout the history of this case, certain of the restrictive covenants that were filed against the properties that are at issue here were found to be in conflict with the MRA, the Menominee Restoration Act. And those covenants are unenforceable, of no further force and effect. However, we are here to ask that the covenants that are not in conflict with the MRA be found to be in full force and effect and enforceable in keeping with that simple statement from Section 3D of the Menominee Restoration Act.
Counsel, I wanted to ask about, I mean, obviously this case has changed midway through, and this is a declaratory judgment action seeking to declare and adjudicate the rights of parties to property. But this is land that is owned by the United States, held in trust for the tribe. I'm trying to figure out how we could possibly issue a declaratory judgment when the party who actually owns the land isn't a part of this case.
Well, the IBIA, which issued an opinion or a decision at one point in this case, stated the covenants are between the association, Kashina, and perhaps the tribe. To whatever extent the association might have a justiciable breach of contract claims against Kashina or the tribe based on the covenants, proper adjudication of these claims lays before a forum other than the board. As appellant argued, a restrictive covenant constitutes a valuable property right which a court of equity will enforce. And I'm going to skip a part there. And then the IBIA states, as we have repeatedly stated, the board is not a court of general jurisdiction, but rather only that authority which has been delegated to it by the secretary. And that is in the record at the defendant's additional authorities filed on April 11th of 2023, page 19. So defendant filed those. And then the the IBIA states that, the regional director's action, okay. We conclude that the covenants cannot render the regional director's actions null and void because whatever state or common law that the appellant relies on to validate such private agreements would be preempted by federal law and rendered unenforceable by the BIA. And then they say those claims raise a contract dispute between private parties that the board has no authority to decide. So the United States is holding these properties in trust. They're being held in trust through a sort of a unique situation where the federal government holds properties in trust for the benefit of the tribe. The language of the IBIA decision and the other authority we seem to have found is that since only certain rights were actually transferred, in other words, restrictive covenants are sets of reciprocal agreements that remove certain property rights from one property and assign those rights permanently to run with the land to other properties. So what was transferred into the trust never really had those rights to begin with. For example, the right to develop each of those restricted properties commercially did not exist at the time that that property was transferred into the tribe. So the United States arguably has no interest in trying to enforce a right that it never had. And by its clear mandate in the MRA, those rights that existed as of the date of being transferred to the United States to be held in trust remain valid and enforceable. And in fact, Section 6C of the MRA states that the land transferred to the secretary pursuant to this subsection shall be subject to foreclosure or sale pursuant to the terms of any valid existing obligation in accordance with the laws of the state of Wisconsin. We are not asking for sale or foreclosure here today. We are simply asking, if we look at our complaint, which is R1 in this case, there are three requests for relief. The first, that the restrictive covenants are valid and legally enforceable. Throughout all the mass of paperwork and cases that I've read and that we've all read in preparation for today, not one mechanism has yet been suggested that would actually make the restrictive covenants vanish. They exist. They are valid and legally enforceable. There may be obstacles. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, you're fine. Counsel, if we did what you're asking us to do, would that have any sort of legal effect on the property itself, which is owned by the United States and trust for the tribe?
I believe it would not, Your Honor, because it would simply be stating that those covenants that were already in full force and effect continue in full force and effect, except to the extent that they are preempted by the MRA.
You're kind of asking us to declare what the rights were as if the transfer to the United States didn't occur, and say that let's look at the law then, and then even though now the land is owned by the United States in trust for the tribe, that we should say those rights then continue. Is that kind of what you're asking us to do? The problem you have is the declaratory judgment action says you can't actually issue a judgment that is against persons who are not party to the proceedings. So, you're asking us to adjudicate the rights of parties. And I understand how the lawsuit started. I understand, why you would like some clarity on this. These are really interesting and complex questions that have far-reaching effects. So I understand all of these things. The problem is this is a court, and you're asking us to declare rights between two parties, and the one party who owns the land that you're asking us to declare rights against isn't in this case.
Well, the BIA decision seems to suggest that it's a private right between the tribe, Mr. Kishina, and potentially future users. The United States, really what we're asking this court to declare is that certain of the restrictive covenants have been invalidated by the MRA, obviously. The non-transfer provisions and the tax roll provisions, as they've come to be called, those were invalidated by the MRA. The restrictive covenants, the bylaws, which are in the record as document 100, as document 122, record 122, have a severability clause in them. So I believe under Olson v. Cottage Grove and other well-known Wisconsin case law on ripeness of declaratory judgment suits, it is ripe for us to come and ask, given that certain of the restrictive covenants were deemed invalidated by the MRA and by the series of events that occurred, do the others remain in full force and effect? We believe that the clear answer to that question is yes. If a suit ever arose against the United States of America in this context, which really, when we think about it, would be extremely unusual, because let's just say hypothetically that at some point in time, in one of the parcels that Mr. Kishina deeded to the trust, which the trust accepted for the benefit of the tribe would assign that parcel to a user who would want to develop it for a commercial use. And the user would say, I want to build, you know, an apartment building here. I mean, it's an absurd example, but, you know, a sky rise or whatever. Maybe that would be residential, but a gas station, right? And we say, okay, we want to sue you in Menominee County Circuit Court and get an injunction that pursuant to these restrictive covenants, which were for the benefit of the association and all the non-transferred parties, you cannot do a commercial use there because these restrictive covenants limit you to single family use. Would the United States of America have any interest, given that they had never been deeded a parcel that gave them the rights to have that sort of use anyway? My answer is an unequivocal no. It just comes to what if the
Council, can I ask a question about that? Because the BIA does get involved in trust lands and things like approving contracts, approving things like extraction of minerals and other natural resources from lands held in trust, and exercises a fiduciary duty with respect to those lands. So if, and I think part of the problem is that I have with this case is we don't know what these association rules are and what the restrictions are that they're imposing on the land, but might there arguably be a situation where the association is attempting to enforce rules that that the U.S. government does have an interest in by virtue of its fiduciary duties to the tribe? Things like what you just pointed to, a restriction on development of the land.
Well, simply determining that in the first instance, the covenants remain enforceable, and they are in the record as R-122, Your Honor. There seems to have been a little bit of a mix-up with the Court of Appeals on certification, and we brought that up in our briefs at page 10, 12, 31, and 32, that the bylaws in their entirety...
The bylaws, but not the association rules. Correct?
Oh, I see what you're saying, Your Honor. Well, certainly the United States of America might be an indispensable party, might be a necessary party in the actual enforcement action when and if such an action should arise.
But you're asking a court at this point to declare that all of those rules are fully enforceable, kind of in the abstract, because we don't know exactly what they are, aren't you?
Well, we are asking exactly as Justice Prosser said in Olson v. Cottage Grove for some clarity on whether the previous decision wiped out the restrictive covenants as a whole, or if we can hold Congress to its word, and if the non-conflicting provisions survive as Section 3D of the MRA and 6C of the MRA so clearly state. And I believe that we have a right in the interest of our clients and the interest of their future lot owners, and simply in the interest of their right to know where they stand vis-a-vis their neighbors, to know that answer.
Council, we have to look at the parties, putting aside the issue of the United States, the parties in front of us, which are Kishina and the tribe. So you're suing essentially those parties, and I would proffer that Kishina is an agent of the tribe in this. I mean, I think I see you nodding, so you agree. So what about the sovereign immunity issue? You have to be, just because something is legally available, or even, I guess you could say, enforceable in the abstract, doesn't mean that the parties against whom you're bringing the suit, you can actually sue. And so I see sovereign immunity as your biggest obstacle here.
Thank you very much for that question, Your Honor. First of all, the actual question asked in our lawsuit do the covenants remain in full force and effect, can actually be answered regardless of whether there's a sovereign immunity problem or not, because sovereign immunity is a defense which may or may not be properly pled in any actual enforcement action down the road, which hasn't occurred yet. So just because the covenants, the non-conflicting restrictive covenants survive, sovereign immunity would not wipe them out. It would simply serve as a shield in some cases. But if I may just finish briefly.
Yes, go ahead.
There is some abrogation of sovereign immunity in the MRA, because if we read Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians v. Coughlin, which is cited throughout our briefs, but it's 599 U.S. 382, if the statute can plausibly be read to preserve sovereign immunity, Congress has not unambiguously expressed the requisite intent to abrogate. But Congress need not use any particular words to pass this clear statement test. If we look at 6C that says, I'm not going to read the entirety of 6C because I'm sure that you're on are very familiar with it, but it says, the land transferred to the secretary pursuant to this subsection shall be subject to foreclosure or sale pursuant to the terms of any valid existing obligation in accordance with the state of Wisconsin. And then 3D, of course, says that the existing property rights and obligations stand. 6C, foreclosure and sale, there must be some abrogation of sovereign immunity to have a foreclosure and sale. Otherwise, it would just be a dead letter. And how can we plausibly read 3D and 6C of the MRA to say anything other than that? But as far as existing property rights, which do not directly conflict with the MRA, sovereign immunity has been abrogated. That is the clear reading. I see no other way to plausibly read that.
Taking you back to the actual case.
Yes.
Kashina's the agent.
Yes.
Tell me, how are you arguing that Kashina had actual authority to waive this? Are you arguing that he had apparent authority? Because Kashina's the one who's dealing with this. He's the one purchasing that property as an agent of the tribe.
That's true, Your Honor. Well, I was talking about abrogation, and now we move to the topic of waiver, which are two separate things.
Well, so, this is the case in front of us, right?
Well, right. Okay, so I believe that the MRA abrogated sovereign immunity, whether or not there was a waiver. I also believe that there was a waiver in this particular case, because the language of the waiver provision was clear and unequivocal. There's no way to understand it as anything other than a waiver of sovereign immunity. Mr. Kashina was an authorized agent, and he went out and bought it on behalf of the tribe. And in fact, if we look at the IBIA decision, it says, and this is at, on the defendant's additional authorities filed 411-2023 at page 10, 68, IBI 288. It is undisputed that Kashina held title to the parcels as an agent of the tribe, and that the properties were purchased after the covenants were adopted and recorded by the association. See appellee's answer brief, May 20th, 2019 at 2-5, and other citations. Copies of the covenants were included with each application for trust acquisition.
But he never negotiated those. The covenants went in place in 2009. Gina purchased the land in 2017, 8 years later. He never negotiated any of the covenants.
There's a problem in that it's a contract of adhesion. I would agree with that. I think that is the weakness. Your Chief Justice, you've cited it quite well. If I were arguing the other side, I would say this is the wrong side of the contract of adhesion stick. However, the reality is that the tribe inserted itself into the transaction when it didn't need to. The tribe would have a much better argument as far as the waiver provision.
Wait, how did the tribe do that? Mr. Kashina purchased the property. He had to do it that way under the MRA in order to be able to transfer the property in trust to the United States government.
Yes, Your Honor, he did not need to do that as an agent of the tribe. He could have just if we really look at how the MRA worked, and I want to back up a minute here, because I feel like the waiver issue is in the big picture. I hope that this court sees its job as one to try to build a better future, and a better future comes from figuring out a way that Congress's intent as to how the Menominee Restoration Act was supposed to work, it actually unfolds that way. And reading that act and the related history, I believe how that's supposed to work is that the tribe and the tribal members are supposed to have the opportunity to repurchase the land and offer it into trust. But those properties that were deeded to others during the period of termination can have their property rights preserved while that process is ongoing, as long as it may take. So the waiver issue, even if this court were to find that in this specific instance it had been waived, then they simply just wouldn't buy it as agents of the tribe anymore. You see what I'm saying? So it's
But as Justice Dalla keeps saying, like, this is the case that's in front of us.
Yes, but the immunity, the sovereign immunity was abrogated under 3D and 6C.
I want to go back to your abrogation argument, because as I read 6C, it talks about foreclosure or sale. Or sale. That's not what we're talking about here.
Well, we're talking about a situation where the properties that were offered into the trust never had, for example, at the time they were offered, the right to develop commercially. That had already been stripped away by the process of the restrictive covenants, which are reciprocal agreements in the form of easements between the properties. So as Justice Roberts said in his concurrence in upper Skagit, in that case, he was talking about the immovable property exception. He said,
which case are you citing?
I'm citing to Upper Skagit Indian Tribe versus Lundgren, 584 U.S. 554.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to make sure I'm following your argument. So you were talking about abrogation, that you were talking about the waiver. Now are you moving on to the sovereign immunity exceptions?
Well, what I'm saying is that the point that Justice Roberts brings up in talking about the immovable property exception, I believe is a very good one, which is that how are people supposed to solve these mundane problems of these lots were not supposed to have the ability to develop commercially. For example, everybody had reciprocal promises, reciprocal easements that are, everybody agrees, the IBIA agrees, Judge Griesbach agreed, are in full force and effect. The Court of Appeals certification cites to the LeMay case. These restrictions are in full force and effect. How do we make sure that these existing property rights are honored while the process of restoration that Congress took a lot of time to figure out unfolds and plays out in a way that keeps peace between everybody and does things in a fair manner? And I am saying that clearly it was abrogated by the MRA in this particular situation due to the way.
There's some additional language in the MRA that I think strongly cuts the other way.
Yes.
Section 2 sub 3B, for example, talks about the prior act, the one stripping the tribe of its rights, is repealed and hereby reinstated all rights and privileges of the tribe or its members under federal treaty, statute, or otherwise, which may have been diminished or lost pursuant to such act. So it seems to me that the MRA is trying to restore the rights as they existed before termination. This land was tribal land before termination. And what you seem to be arguing here is that this association of private landowners can come in the interval and tie up this land for 100 years and restrict the tribe's right to develop the land, to use it commercially. That would include things like logging on the land, I would assume, that allow the tribe to develop its treasury from the land. How do you square your argument on abrogation with the language in the MRA that clearly is trying to restore the tribe's rights over this land to the way they existed before abrogation or before termination?
Well, first of all, this land was sold during the time of termination through the Menominee Enterprises Incorporated. And so the people who bought it at that time bought it in good faith. They were not trying to tie up anybody's property.
Well, the association is the party that came in and imposed the restrictive covenants, not the individual landowners. That's the party before us is the association.
Yes, and the association was created during the period of termination pursuant to restrictive covenants that were approved by the MEI.
And the restrictive covenants seem pretty clearly intended to prohibit the tribe from getting this land back as tribal lands.
Some did, Your Honor, and those were deemed unenforceable. Those are gone. What we're talking about now is the ones that govern the orderly development and use of the neighborhood. And quite frankly, the part that you just said is correct, because to some extent, all the land that's back in the tribe in the reservation goes by the rule in State v. Webster, which talks about, they say, we note at the outset that the Supreme Court has rejected the view that states are absolutely barred from exercising jurisdiction over tribal reservations and members. Here we have properties that are literally half in and half out. They're half in because their fee simple interest has been offered into the trust, but they're half out because they are encumbered with restrictive covenants that connect them to every other lot that is in the Legend Lake Property Owners Association that hasn't been offered in yet. The tribe and Mr. Kashina could have, but did not, negotiate a release of those restrictive covenants with the association and the other members. They could have negotiated that. Or the United States could have condemned those restrictive covenants. We all know that the United States of America is capable of condemning any easement or restrictive covenant. But until that has been done, to simply say that by the act of transferring those lots to the United States of America and America accepting them, may I finish my answer? Would erase all of the non-conflicting restrictive covenants would be a taking without just compensation. And it would be essentially turning Congress's promise in the MRA into a lie. And we ask that that not happen. Thank you.
Chief, may I have an opportunity to ask a question?
Absolutely.
Council, I'm having a really hard time with the indispensable party argument that you proffered in response to some other questions. From everything I can see, the United States has to be a necessary and indispensable party. 100% of the parcels at issue were transferred into trust held by the United States. Can you explain to me once again your argument?
If we look at 803.03 and persons be joined if feasible, then the test is whether whether complete relief can be accorded among those already in the case in the absence of the person. We believe they can, because simply saying that the non-conflicting provisions remain in full force and effect, there may be barriers to enforcing them, but at this phase that they remain in full force and effect costs the United States nothing and hurts the United States in no way whatsoever. The United States can still do whatever it wants in the future litigation to protect them. And I could go through the whole analysis of 803, 1A, B1, and B2, which we did in our brief, and 803.03. To the extent that, and I'll just go to the punchline, if you will, which is that even if the United States needed to be a party, and the United States said it didn't want to be a party, and we couldn't join them, and they were deemed indispensable, then we would still get to continue as long as we could do so in what is the verbiage, equity and good faith, or. It's in our brief, and I'm sorry, I've become just a little bit tongue-tied at this moment, but it cannot possibly be that the MRA says that the existing property rights and obligations stand, and the neighbors say, okay, well, it's going to be offered into the tribe, but at least we know that these rules will be abided by and things will be kept nice and orderly. And then it turns out not only that it isn't possible to, it ends up being a dead letter, because when we try to enforce it, we hit this roadblock of sovereign immunity. So it's just not, in my humble opinion, Your Honor, it's not a plausible reading of the MRA. It's a reading which can be kind of act out of it in a tortured sense, but what should really happen is the intent of this law should be honored. And lastly, if this court were to find that the United States was an indispensable party, because of the contours of this case, which started before the properties were offered in, we would ask for the opportunity to go back and attempt to add them and see what they would say about this whole thing. Because at this point in time, Your Honor, we are still at the motion to dismiss stage, almost unbelievably so, but we are still at the motion to dismiss phase.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Attorney Wright, as you are approaching the podium, I'm just going to ask if you've been admitted pro hac vice. Whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. The circuit court correctly held that the Menominee tribe's sovereign immunity requires dismissal of this case and that the Menominee Restoration Act preempts the restrictive covenants. In my argument, I will address sovereign immunity, indispensable party, and preemption in public policy. My colleague, Mr. Dash, will then address the remaining issues. The Menominee Restoration Act was enacted in 1973 to reverse the termination of the tribe by Congress in 1954. It restored the tribe's legal status as a sovereign Indian tribe and provided for the transfer of lands owned by tribal members in Menominee County to the United States in trust for the tribe free of state and local taxation and regulation. The Legend Lake development is within Menominee County. In 2009, 36 years after enactment of the Menominee Restoration Act, and after over 700 parcels within Legend Lake had been acquired in trust for the tribe, LLPOA adopted the restrictive covenants in this case. They brought this case after Mr. Kishina bought lands within Menominee County on behalf of the tribe and tendered them to the U.S. in trust for the tribe. And of course, those lands are now in trust for the tribe. Turning to sovereign immunity, the tribe's sovereign immunity bars this suit. First, I'll address a point that was raised in the oral argument that this is not an enforcement action. So it was suggested that sovereign immunity somehow doesn't bar declaratory judgment action, but only would bar subsequent enforcement action. That's certainly not the law. There's no support for that. It's never been argued, and there's no case to support that. So what is the law is that to sue an Indian tribe, you must show either a clear abrogation of immunity by Congress or an unequivocal waiver of sovereign immunity by the tribe. In Michigan versus Bay Mills Indian Community, the Supreme Court stated, quote, that an abrogation, quote, must be clear, end quote. In CNL Enterprises versus Citizen Band Potawatomi Indian Tribe, the Supreme Court stated, quote, to abrogate tribal immunity, Congress must unequivocally express the purpose, end quote. In Santa Clara Pueblo versus Martinez, the Supreme Court said that a tribe's waiver, quote, cannot be implied, but must be unequivocally expressed.
Your friend on the other side says that Section 6C of the Menominee Restoration Act gets this issue, that it was clear that when Congress passed that what they were doing was, on behalf of the tribe, clearly waiving sovereign immunity. That was expressed abrogation of the tribe's immunity.
That is not the language of abrogation. There is a right created, and LLPOA relies on this sentence from Section 6C about preserving rights, but it doesn't provide any express abrogation of tribal immunity. There is the following sentence that was referred to by LLPOA in argument, referring to foreclosures and sales, and LLPOA has acknowledged at oral argument today they're not seeking a foreclosure or sale, so it doesn't come within that language. So there's just no, I'm not conceding that's even language of abrogation, but if it were, it doesn't apply in this case anyway. There are cases where Congress abrogates sovereign immunity, and it's not good enough for the plaintiff in that case. For example, the Michigan versus Bay Mill Indian Community case that I referred to. Bay Mills Indian Community had a gaming compact with the state of Michigan, like tribes in Wisconsin have with the state. And Bay Mills opened a casino, a second casino, that arguably was not on Indian lands. They had bought some other land. They said it was Indian land. Michigan said it wasn't. And they brought a suit against them, and they lost on sovereign immunity because the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act has an abrogation of sovereign immunity where a state can sue a tribe if it's illegally gaming on Indian lands. And the Supreme Court said the problem you have, Michigan, is you're bringing a suit for lands, a gaming that's not on Indian lands. And it's certainly illegal to game, you know, to conduct gaming on lands that aren't Indian lands. The problem is you don't have an abrogation of immunity that would allow this suit to proceed. You'll have to find some other way to shut that down, a criminal action or something. Santa Clara Pueblo versus Martinez. The United States Congress enacted a law, the Indian Civil Rights Act, that extended the Bill of Rights to Indian tribes because they're not in the Constitution the same way as the states. So one of the clauses was tribes have to grant equal protection to their members. A female member of the tribe sued and said, I'm not being granted equal protection. And she lost because the only abrogation of immunity in the Indian Civil Rights Act was for habeas corpus, because Congress was worried about imprisoning. Indians were being imprisoned, and they didn't provide a remedy for any of the other provisions of the act. And so that plaintiff lost because the abrogation did not go that far.
Counsel, I'm sorry, I want to let you finish your answer if you still have
more. Well, I was just going to say, you know, when I see in the brief and I hear it all our argument, LLPO arguing that there must be an abrogation. That's just arguing for an abrogation by implication that there's got to be something, but it just isn't in the statute.
Can you help me understand how this works in practice? Is it with regard to these like association rules? And part of the hard part about this case that I'm having, I don't know what rules are attempting to be enforced. I mean, are we talking about, you know, no swimming pools? Are we talking about, you know, fences, setbacks? Are we talking about building a gas station? Are we talking about, you know, keep your driveway snowblowed? I don't even know what we're talking about sometimes. So I want to figure out, like, is for this land that has been transferred, do these rules, does the tribe's position that they're subject to some rules, no rules? How is it enforced? Can you just give us some kind of background context for what this looks like on the ground? Yeah. I don't want you to go outside the record,
well,
by the
I'll,
way,
I'll say,
for that.
And
I'm just
looking at LLPOA's brief at page 10, they refer to building and use regulations such as prohibition against commercial use, restriction on cutting trees. You know, it's that kind of thing. My co-counsel, Mr. Dash, will address that we think these issues are not even presented in this appeal and they're not right. But as a practical matter, I think it's important to put in the context, you know, how much land is in trust and how has this worked? So the Restoration Act was enacted in 1973. Legend Lake already existed. By 1975, 700 properties within Legend Lake were in trust for the tribe. And I'll refer to the document in the record at index 83, page 83. In November 2020, the number in trust was 813, and that's in the record, it's index document 73 at page 2. So there were hundreds of properties that went into trust before these restrictive covenants were even adopted in 2009. And I think it's important to note the restrictive covenants state on page 1 that they do not apply to lands that had already been acquired in trust. So those 700 plus parcels that had gone into trust before 2009 are not even subject to these. So the situation on the ground is that the great majority of these trust parcels are not subject to the restrictive covenants. You know, the one since 2009 would be.
Well, counsel, is there, did you have more?
Go ahead.
Okay, is there, so with respect to the restrictive covenants, if the tribe has sovereign immunity and is therefore cannot be sued, does it even matter what, like, let's take the ones that there were restrictive covenants in effect. Does it even matter what they are? Is there any possible scenario that any possible restrictive covenant can possibly be enforced against the tribe?
No, if sovereign immunity applies, then sovereign immunity applies. And I think LLPOA's argument sort of confuses the right and the remedy. When the court is deciding an issue of sovereign immunity, it doesn't go to the merits of the case and decide whether a right actually exists. The whole point of sovereign immunity is, you know, the sovereign's immunity. You don't have jurisdiction over the case. You don't decide the case.
So if they didn't waive it, if it wasn't abrogated, then there's no way to bring.
That's correct.
On the waiver issue, can you talk about? I want to hear your argument about you talked about the U.S. government not abrogating, but what about the issue of the tribal waiver?
Okay. Well, Mr. Kushina was not authorized to waive sovereign immunity. And the tribe's constitution has rules about sovereign immunity and doesn't allow the tribe to waive sovereign immunity in state court. LLPOA doesn't really argue otherwise. They argued in their brief that the court should adopt a minority rule and find that Mr. Kushina had apparent authority. Apparent authority wouldn't be shown in this case.
Well, I think, but if I understood Attorney Olson's argument correctly a few minutes ago, he talked about an easement and he talked about the as far as the covenants that somehow, and I'm not sure I fully understand this, that the tribe could have negotiated the restricted covenants away. You're nodding your head. Okay, I got that,
yeah,
right.
Well, the restrictive covenants, of course, were not negotiated. Let's look at the actual wording. Because the LLPOA is relying on a restrictive covenant. It's Article 4G of the restrictive covenants. It's in appellant's appendix at page 019. And it's titled Waiver of Defense. And it begins by stating, by acceptance of a deed transferring title ownership of any portion of the subject real estate, the title owner waives, and it goes on to say sovereign immunity. Okay, so that's what they're relying. And I would argue this, what they're trying to do here is change the rules of sovereign immunity. The rules of sovereign immunity are very clear that a tribe has to waive sovereign immunity. A tribe's waiver must be expressed. This is not an express waiver of a tribe, a waiver of immunity by a tribe. This is LLPOA recording a covenant where they want to change the rule and say, well, if you do this, you've waived immunity. And that's really not the law. And that's really the way these restrictive covenants were designed. You know, the restraint on transferring lands and taking them off the tax rolls to prevent the trust transaction, that was designed to overcome the Menominee tribe's rights under the Menominee Restoration Act. It's no longer in this case, but similarly here, this is trying to overcome the sovereign immunity. It's not an express way. It's arguing that there's a waiver by action of the tribe. And we'll note, again, the tribe had a pre-existing constitution where the tribe does not waive its immunity, actually preserves its immunity in state court. And imagine this sentence, that there's been a lot of questions from the bench about the United States now being an owner. So imagine you apply the same rule to the United States. So the United States has now accepted deeds to all of these properties. Some official at the Bureau of Indian Affairs accepted those deeds. Did that official, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, by taking those deeds, waive the immunity of the United States? I don't think so. I don't think accepting a deed waives the United States' sovereign immunity. I don't think it waives the tribe's sovereign immunity.
And with respect to the apparent authority argument, Kushina's not dealing directly with the association.
That's correct.
What could the reliance possibly
that's
be?
Correct. Yeah. In the apparent authority case, there was a case cited, the Rush Creek case out of Colorado. And in that case, the tribe's chief financial officer executes a contract. The tribe's then signed on the contract. The tribe says, hey, our CFO had authority to enter into contracts, but not to waive sovereign immunity. Only tribal council could do that. And they said that even though, unlike the Menominee tribe, they didn't have any language in their constitution about sovereign immunity. And the tribe lost because this was a negotiated contract. And what the court found in that case is that the contracting party could reasonably rely on indicia of authority. Well, there's no reliance here. Mr. Kushina wasn't sitting down on the other side of a table with LLPOA and signing anything. There's nothing like the facts in the apparent authority cases.
Counsel, I want to just go back to my question. I'm still trying to figure out how some of this works in practice, just to make sure I'm figuring out what's going on. Is it the tribe's position that there is no way to enforce any association rules whatsoever? For example, you need to, in Milwaukee where I grew up, you needed to shovel your sidewalk within a certain time frame or else you could get cited, right? So if you're an association, you need to, keep your trees cut, whatever. Is the tribe's position that Legend Lake as a property association cannot enforce any rules whatsoever with respect to these properties now?
I think that probably is the position. I can't think of a lawsuit that would be allowed to go forward. In their constitution, they allow suits in tribal court for certain things by persons subject to tribal jurisdiction. I don't know that this would come in any of those. I haven't studied it, closely enough to really tell you that. But certainly the tribal constitution says you can't sue us in state court.
Okay, so it doesn't matter, going to Justice Dowd's question, nothing about the rules themselves, any kind of rules from your position, matters with respect to whether the tribe has agreed to anything and therefore ever waived it. You're just saying whatever the rules are, they can't be enforced or they can't be adopted in the lands that are now in trust, are not subject to any of the association rules whatsoever. Is that right?
We're not subject to enforcement, I think.
So voluntary agreement,
yeah. It's possible the parties could agree. I mean, as I've noted, there are over 800 lots in Legend Lake that are in trust for the tribe right now. Most of them aren't subject to the restrictive covenants, but some are. And there'll probably be more in the future. In this case, there were 33 that have gone in trust. And it's certainly, these are neighbors and they could sit down and talk.
Yeah. Association dues all the same way, like they can't be assessed, no association dues?
I'm sorry.
Association dues, property association dues, those can't be assessed, or there can be no enforcement of those?
Right. There were association dues. That's one of the things they mention in their brief that they say are at issue. And
Okay.
Attorney Roy, I'm interested in hearing your indispensable party argument. And I'm curious as to how you see that argument fit with your sovereign immunity argument. Are you asking us to make a decision on indispensable party, then make a decision on sovereign immunity? Can we decide one without the other? How do these two fit together?
I think if you hold that the tribe is immune from suit, you could stop there and not reach the indispensable party argument. By the same token, if you held that the United States was an indispensable party, you could not reach the sovereign immunity argument. But it seems, usually logically in a case, the sovereign immunity argument proceeds first. And if the defendant's immune, you stop there.
Counsel, let me just clarify one point on that. Is it your position that if this court were to find the tribe has sovereign immunity in this case, that it would be improper for us to reach the indispensable party issue as well? Or do you think that the court would have jurisdiction to reach an issue like indispensable party?
No, I think the court could, in its discretion, reach that issue.
Okay. And can you elaborate on why you believe that's the case?
I think it need not. Well, it's an important procedural issue, and it's not resolving. If you decide sovereign immunity, you certainly can't decide the merits of the case, right? But given that indispensable party is a procedural issue that goes to jurisdiction, I think you could decide that at the same time.
Oh, so indispensable party also goes to jurisdiction? It's a separate jurisdictional question, which I understand sovereign immunity is a jurisdictional question.
Right.
Is it indispensable party as well?
I don't have a citation on that, Your Honor.
Okay. Let me just ask another follow-up on the issue of waiver. So I just want to be clear about one point. The association points to language in the restrictive covenants that talk about the party acquiring the deed or the title holder. And here, the tribe never held the land in Fee Simple before the transfer. Is that correct?
Before the termination of the tribe, these were Menominee lands.
Yes. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the when Kachina acquired
Kachina
the land. He did that solely without the tribe as being a, you know, purchasing as a joint purchaser. He purchased the lands as an individual tribal member. Is that correct?
Well, as he did as an agent for the tribe.
As an agent for the tribe. So was the tribe on the deed or not on the deed, I think is what I'm...
The deed, as I recall, said something to the effect of Mr. Kachina for and on behalf of the Menominee Indian tribe.
Okay. And does that, in your opinion, affect how we read and apply the language in the restrictive covenant or not?
Not as to waiver, no.
Okay. And your analysis is that, can you just walk me through that one more time? I know you already did, but.
Again, that's not, there's no express waiver by the tribe.
Yeah.
There is this language that I referred to and the restrictive covenants on sovereign immunity that LLPOA relies on. And we assert that the tribe never agreed with that. It wasn't negotiated. And that you couldn't unilaterally require tribes to waive sovereign immunity by recording a deed restriction that says any purchase to waive sovereign immunity.
All right. I think you also rely on the tribe's constitution, which has a specific mechanism for waiving immunity.
Not only just a mechanism, but just does not allow waivers in state court.
Ah, okay. Thanks.
Just to follow up on, if the United States is an indispensable party, and let's suppose there was an enforcement action that was brought, who would it be brought against? Would it be brought against the United States because they own the land? Would they be brought against the tribe?
I think that's one of the problems and one of the things we point out in an indispensable party argument. You know, someone mentioned dues. Who pays the dues? You know, if this is, I mean, does the United States pay the dues? Does the tribe pay the dues? You know, you could have inconsistent judgments or, you know, different cases. The owner's not, you know, the United States is the owner's not before the court, and you're being asked to hold that, among other things, apparently, that this dues provision that Mr. Dash will argue is not before you, but that LLPOA is asking you to decide the dues. You know, the United States is not here.
Well, I think Legend Lake argues that if we believe the United States is an indispensable party, the matter needs to be remanded. What are your thoughts?
Right. Well, so they're arguing you don't have to go so far as to find, you could say that the suit could nonetheless proceed and you could remand it. First of all, we just disagree. We think in equity and good conscience, it couldn't proceed without the United States. For example, the judgment wouldn't be adequate because you don't have the owner here and who pays the dues. That's one of our arguments. But even if you remanded it, I mean, it's just the case is just going to be dismissed because the United States has not waived its immunity to suits in state courts on property. They have waived their immunity in the Quiet Title Act, 28 U.S. Code, Section 2409. They've waived their immunity to suits on property. But then they've carved out of that, trust property. So the United States cannot be sued on a trust property. And the United States, in the federal court case that's been referred to, the LLPOA case, the United States, I see I have a red light. Should I finish this?
Please finish your answer.
In that case, LLPOA did try to raise this argument that said, well, even if you uphold the trust transactions, the court can reach the issue of these other non-transfer provisions and hold that they are enforceable, which they did not hold. The court did not get there, by the way. But in opposing that, in their reply brief, the United States said, we can't do that for a couple of reasons. One, it's not before you because the IBIA did not rule on that, and it's not relevant to this case. But number two, you can't because, you know, that would be in violation of the Quiet Title Act. This is not a lawsuit under the Quiet Title Act. The Quiet Title Act carves out trust properties So we have an interest in those properties, and it would bar any case against us for arguing that these non-transfer provisions apply. And their brief and that argument from that brief is in our supplemental appendix at page 133. Thank you.
Thank you, Attorney Roy. Attorney Dash?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is James Dash, and like Mr. Roy, I represent Mr. Kishina and the Menominee Tribe of Wisconsin. Before proceeding, I do want to make clear a record reference. Mr. Roy had stated that the number of parcels in trust prior to the restrictive covenants at issue as being 700 plus. It's in the record at document 83, page 38, not 83. I believe you said 83.
Thanks for that.
Mr. Roy discussed the issues involving federal law and the federal government. I am here to argue two issues of state law. Number one, whether there are any issues remaining in this case that are ripe for decision and therefore justiciable, and time permitting, if so, whether the 2009 amendment to the restrictive covenants encumber the properties at issue because they violate the statute of frauds with stat 706.021. A couple of times here, Your Honors have noted the case before us. There is no issue remaining in this case that is ripe for decision. After LLPOA's reply brief in the Court of Appeals was filed, but before the Court of Appeals issued its certification on January 22, 2025, the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin ruled that the tax and transfer provisions of the 2009 restrictive covenants were unenforceable. Since the federal court's decision became final in early 2024, LLPOA has expressly stated in the Court of Appeals and in this court that it is, quote, no longer seeking a ruling on the transfer restriction or tax roll provisions. So the question naturally arises, if the transfer restriction and tax roll provisions are no longer subject to dispute, what is? Well, LLPOA shifts its focus in this court to what it calls the, quote, unquote, non-transfer provisions, which it now says may be severed from the transfer provisions and separately ruled on. The case cited at page 10 of the respondent's brief, this court's decision in Olson versus Town of Cottage Grove, is one of this court's more recent comprehensive analyses on the issue of ripeness, which directly affects the jurisdiction of this court and all courts because it is an essential element of justiciability. Citing this court's 1976 decision in Lister versus Board of Regents, this court noted that the underlying philosophy of the Uniform Declaratory Judgments Act enable controversies of a justiciable nature to be brought before the courts for settlement and determination prior to a time that a wrong has been threatened or committed. That's Olson at paragraph 28, citing Lister. Olson requires that real, precise, and immediate harm will come to a plaintiff seeking a declaratory judgment. It does not permit adjudication of hypothetical, abstract, or remote questions. Two cases decided by this court since Olson, Papa versus Department of Health and Coyne versus Walker, hold that facts must be, quote, sufficiently developed to allow a conclusive adjudication. Let's look at the record in this case. The complaint filed by LLPOA is document number one in the record. And while the complaint alleges the transfer of lots to Mr. Kishina on behalf of the tribe in paragraphs 19 to 21 are in violation of the restrictive covenants, there is not a single allegation of any actual or threatened violation of the so-called non-transfer restrictions, bylaws, rules, or regulations. So, as Justice Hagedorn pointed out a couple of times, what association bylaws, rules, regulations is LLPOA seeking to enforce here? Whatever they may be, they're not alleged in the complaint.
So are you just asking us to find that the matter's not justiciable and stop? Is that what your argument is? Or do you want us to reach the other matters that we've already discussed, such as the sovereign immunity? I'm not quite sure what your request is.
I get that there's a tension there, Your Honor. and the question here is, did the trial court, whose judgment you're reviewing, correctly decide to dismiss this case? Is the order reversible error? The answer is it's not reversible error. It was perfectly appropriate. So, and you can only dismiss it once. So on any given ground, it really doesn't matter. Order was dismissed, that order gets affirmed. So you don't have any allegations in this complaint about any of those things, the dues, the shoveling the snow. You don't have any alleged actual or threatened violations of any of these matters.
Just to be clear, I think so the answer to Justice Protasiewicz's question is, yes, this would be another independent ground on which we could affirm the trial court, in your view.
That's correct.
This is not justiciable, that we therefore would be inappropriate for us to issue any kind of, you can't get to the declaratory judgment action. There's nothing for us to decide here that would be non-advisory.
Anything beyond what the federal court has already decided. Yeah. That is correct.
Yeah.
Counsel, there would be a difference, though, with respect to the finality of that judgment, wouldn't there? Because if it were dismissed on grounds of lack of ripeness, presumably claims could become ripe as things went forward and a new lawsuit could be filed, versus if we were to hold that the tribe has sovereign immunity, that would appear to shut the door on any future claims, right?
Your Honor, if you're asking, would we prefer to win on the merits? The answer is yes.
Well, what do you mean by the merits, though? Do you mean,
I mean sovereign immunity, or anything that doesn't allow?
That's more conclusive and more final.
That is correct.
Okay.
So what LLPOA is actually seeking here is just a general advisory opinion sought for the first time after regular briefing was completed in the Court of Appeals and now in the Supreme Court, that its bylaws, rules, and regulations, no specific one of which is cited or even mentioned in the complaint, are generally enforceable. So unlike in Olson, there is no real, precise, and immediate harm that will come to LLPOA in the event the court does not enter declaratory judgment. I see I have the red light on, so unless you want me to finish, I'm done.
You can finish your sentence. Thank you. Done with your sentence.
Yes, rather, these are exactly the type of abstract or remote questions that Olson and the decisions analyzed in that case say are not ripe for determination and non-justiciable. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
The restrictive covenants, which are in the record, and the bylaws, which are document 122, have rules such as the maximum height for the principal structure shall be 35 feet, and a minimum of 760 square feet must be provided in the main floor living area, exclusive of porches. These are typical bylaws that you would find in any sort of a homeowners association or condominium. Restrictive covenants are like easements. They are something that has been severed from the land. What if, hypothetically, you had two lots, one of which had an easement over the first one, and that was its only way of accessing the road? The first one is offered into the trust. Does the easement vanish and leave the second one landlocked under the MRA? My answer is that unequivocally it doesn't. Going back to Justice Crawford's very good question, yes, 1B, or I'm sorry, 3B of the MRA attempts to restore all of the rights of the reservation that existed previously, but it cannot render 3D and 6C dead letters. It cannot render Congress's intent that the rights that already existed would be preserved until such a time simply a fallacy, something that was said but not enforced, something that was not really a right.
Counsel, I want to pick up on one of the comments made by your opposing counsel.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to rights versus remedies.
Sure.
Because there is a line of case law cited in the Court of Appeals DNR decision that distinguishes between the fact that there a party may have a legal right, but that doesn't mean that right can be enforced against a tribe in state court due to sovereign immunity. Can you comment on that? What because I think that goes to the heart of your claims that sovereign immunity is abrogated implicitly in this case because the association can point to rights, legal rights that it has.
Well, 6D of the Restoration Act says that you can have a sale and foreclosure action under state law, and it says such property shall be subject to all valid existing rights. If we look at Judge Griesbach's decision, in, which was mentioned by opposing counsel, which was Legend Lake Property Owners Association versus United States Department of the Interior, 23 CV 480, that was February 6, 2024, Judge Griesbach states, the enforceability of the association's restrictive covenants that were not relevant to the trust acquisitions was never addressed by the BIA or the IBIA. Because this argument was not addressed in the underlying final agency decision, the court will not decide it here.
Well, and Judge Griesbach was not opining that the association could sue the tribe in state court. He wasn't saying anything about sovereign immunity in that decision that I can tell.
Yes, he was essentially, my understanding of what Judge Griesbach was saying was, you need to go elsewhere to find out the answer of that question. And I'm representing an association, a room full of people who want to know, when people come to buy their lots, do they have to tell people that all of those lots that were transferred through Mr. Kishina can do essentially whatever they want? And we have absolutely no ability to stop them if they care to violate our restrictive covenants in any way, shape, or form. We have no way to stop them. And what we are asking this court to say is that those restrictive covenants that do not conflict with the MRA, that are saved under 3D and 6C of the MRA, remain in full force and effect. There may be hurdles to enforcing them.
Counsel, is that all of them or some of them? And does that matter to your analysis? I mean, it sounds like you're saying at least some of them may survive. So, you know, that seems to almost get to this justiciability question here that, you know, what's being enforced here? I mean, you're not trying to enforce anything in particular. So trying to figure out, you know, in the abstract, which I think Justice Crawford used, you know, what you're asking us to decide in the abstract. And
yeah, well, it's not in the abstract because either they were all invalidated or some of them survived. And if some of them survived, then it is left to another day as the enforcement of each one comes up to try to do it. But as Justice Prosser said in the Olson case, there is some right that we have under a declaratory judgment action to come into court and ask, do we have any existing restrictive covenants at all, or have they been stripped away by some mechanism that no one yet has been able to identify?
Can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
So if sovereign immunity applies, is it your position that some of these restrictive covenants could be still enforced? Or do you agree that if we say that there's sovereign immunity here, that there's none of them can be?
Our position is that if sovereign immunity applies, if the MRA didn't abrogate it and it wasn't waived, then the case ends right there because it deprives this honorable court of jurisdiction. It's over. Nothing else gets decided. The underlying restrictive covenants like easements are still sitting there because nobody has ever
they're there, but the
it would be erased.
They're there, but you can't do anything about it. But you can't sue, right? You can't
enforce. It would be like Congress saying prisoners will be fed three meals a day, but the meals will be off in a high tower where nobody can ever eat them. That would be pretty strange, but perhaps that's what Congress meant. It is up to this honorable court to decide.
Thank you for the arguments. We will stand adjourned, and we will meet at 1:30 in closed conference. Thank you.